We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings, as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
Good evening, everybody. Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is Friday night, December 19, 2014, here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We are here every Friday night live at 11 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern, 2 hours live every Friday night. So if you're listening in on a Saturday replay or on our free stream throughout the week, now you know when you can listen to the show live. Friday nights, 11 Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern. Very exciting show tonight. Christmas is coming, everybody. The holiday season is upon us. And so this will likely be the last live show for 2 weeks. We'll be back in early 2015 with a brand new show. There is always the possibility that we will do a show. So follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on the Dark Matter Radio Network. If there is a change, I will make sure to let everybody know. We might also have a special episode coming up because the time is nearing when I am preparing to do a ghost investigation at an old dojo that I used to teach at, which is over 100 years old. And we've got a whole bunch of stuff. We got a whole bunch of equipment that we are going to use for this ghost hunt. On that topic, tonight, we are going to be joined by Christopher Keegan. He is an actor in the UK, and he has got a lot of theater experience, and he has got a lot of stories about haunted theaters, what people have seen, what people have heard, what people have experienced. We're going to be telling ghost stories on the program here tonight, talking all matters of the supernatural with Chris Keegan, starting in about a half an hour. Up until that point, as always, here on Friday night, it is going to be an open lines program. If you want to give us a call, you are welcome to do so. The phone number is 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. We have also got two separate numbers, depending on where you are here in the U.S. If you are west of the Rockies, you can call 425-488-0525. If you are east of the Rockies, you can call 425-482-1686. So the phone lines will be opening up here very soon, and we will be taking your phone calls. Any topic under the sun, you are welcome to talk about on the program here tonight. If you would like to contact me via email, and I will read emails here on the program if you want to email me, the address is Brian at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Brian with a Y, B-R-Y-A-N, at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. I am also available on Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. If you want to tweet me there, anything on your mind, I monitor that during the show. And we have a great Facebook page. My buddy Andrew does a tremendous job updating the Facebook page throughout the day. All sorts of interesting stories, photos, everything under the sun. Anything Dark Matter, After Dark Radio Show or related, it is up there on the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. If you missed anything that I talked about, I recommend you head up to our website. The address is AfterDarkRadioShow.com. All of the phone numbers, the email address, the Twitter handle, everything is up there at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Also, information about how to contact our producer, Garrett, who always does a tremendous job getting guests for this program. If you think you would be a great guest or you have a guest request, producer Garrett is the guy to contact. The guest booking information is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We also, of course, have a link to the stream, the Dark Matter Radio Network, which I'm sure many of you are aware of. And every evening, every Friday night at 1 Pacific, 4 Eastern, when this program goes off the air, we put this show on as a free replay on the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com. You can listen to the show 24/7 on our free stream. We actually have the last 5 episodes of the program airing 24/7 throughout the day. So if you've been gone on vacation, if you've missed any of the past shows, you can always listen to the free stream, which is available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, as well as TuneIn Radio, searching After Dark Radio. Tell your friends about that one. And you can download a copy of this program on the After Dark Radio Show website. It's only up there for a week, so if you miss out, you're not going to be able to hear it. So if you've not heard last week's show with Nina Teicholz, it is up right now at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, so head up there and check that out. And that is all the plugs for the evening. Let's kick this show off to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Ryan, what's going on?
I got a story from you. It happened back in 1998 when I was a senior in high school.
All right.
And I think it's pretty appropriate based on who you have on your show because it's a haunted story.
Oh, good.
Okay. Involves a CD called The Great Malenko by the Insane Clown Posse, which is probably what you're familiar with considering you're a wrestling fan.
I am well aware of that. And are you well aware that I have interviewed Violent J? It is in the archives at WrestlingObserver.com.
I did not know this.
Oh, yeah, it's a great interview.
Well, you might have to ask him about this story that I'm about to tell you.
All right.
Okay, I was listening to the CD down in my parents' basement. On about the 9th or 10th song, the CD appeared to skip, but all it said was 6666. It kept repeating that over and over again until I finally unplugged the CD player.
So it was apparently skipping, but it was skipping in such a way to repeatedly say 666.
Correct. What made that strange is, if you're familiar with the CD, The Great Malenko, at the beginning of the CD, a possession occurs with the music box. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
No, explain this.
Well, basically, it's like a, like a music player. It gets possessed. That's like the skit that they do before they start playing the first song.
I see.
On The Great Malenko.
Now, was there a song on The Great Malenko, I presume there was, that involved the number 6?
I don't believe so. What people have told me is maybe it skipped on sex.
I see.
I know, but it sounded like 6 to me. And I was so concerned about this that I once wrote a letter to a wrestling newsletter. It wasn't the Wrestling Observer. I used a fake name and told this story because I was afraid that Violent J or Shaggy Two-Tip they might come after me.
You're afraid they might? And what would they do if they came after you?
Well, I was afraid that maybe they could like cast a spell on me or beat me up since they're from the mean streets of Detroit.
So you thought that maybe this was purposely done by the Insane Clown Posse, putting 666 in this CD?
I didn't know if it was maybe like a secret track that I came upon or if it was just coincidental, which seems a little funny because I've listened to hundreds of CDs and nothing like this has ever happened before.
Now, I don't have any CDs anymore, but when I was younger, obviously, I did. And when a CD skipped, there was usually a scratch on it. So did you then go and put the CD back in and see if it skipped again in that same spot?
I never listened to the CD again because I was so terrified of the CD, I gave it away to my nephew.
You gave it away to your nephew?
Yep.
What a horrible uncle. You cursed this poor fella. Is he all right today?
I think so. I don't get to see a whole lot of him like, he wasn't home for Thanksgiving because he decided to go to a wedding, so hopefully he's okay. I think he does pretty well up at Penn State. He gets really good grades, so must have not been too bad of an experience.
Well, listen, Ryan, what I want you to do when I let you go here is I want you to go on the internet, and I want you to Google the great Malenko and 666 and see if you can find any other reports of this baffling phenomenon.
I don't believe I've ever seen anything. That's why I was asking you. Maybe you had an inside scoop on it since you know Shaggy too, dope.
No, I've never heard of this in my life. But I vow, if I interview Violent J again, I will ask him about the 666 on the Great Malenko CD. Deal?
Okay, that's greatly appreciated.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for the call, Ryan. A story I have never heard before. A magic, a secret track? What was it? Or was his CD just skipping? And he never went back and listened to it to find out. If you want to give us a call tonight, 855-478-4478. Toll free in the United States and Canada. That is 855-478-4478. Give us a call. Drop us an email. Drop us a tweet. However you'd like to contact us here on this program. And don't forget, in about 20 minutes, we are going to be joined by Chris Keegan. We're going to be talking haunted theaters in the UK, ghost stories, of which there are in abundance. Not to mention a lot of alcoholism, as he noted in the interview. It was pre-taped earlier today, I might add, so we will not be taking calls during the interview. But I can tell you that he talks about a very fascinating and frightening photo. And I have got the photo all queued up. So around the time that he begins talking about it on the program tonight, I am going to send it out on my Twitter. So make sure you follow me at Brian Alvarez, and you can see a very creepy ghost photo later this evening. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian, it's Shane from Orange County.
What's up, Shane?
Hey, bro. I just listened to the Brian and Vinny show. Don't worry, I'm not going to talk wrestling, but I just want to say, dude, my grandma had the same thing Granny got, and I'm really glad she came out of it like my grandma did.
Really? For those of you that didn't listen to the show, last week my grandmother, who's 85 years old, was stricken with what ended up being transient global amnesia, which meant for about 12 hours, she could not remember anything past about 1 minute ago. And we all thought, I didn't think the worst, but I was pretty worried because I thought this has got to be either a stroke or a concussion. Something bad had to have happened to my grandmother is what I thought. But instead, it is very mysterious. It appears to be very benign. She was completely recovered within 24 hours. She's had no issues since. Tell me what happened to your grandmother.
Yeah, same thing as Granny, where she's super, super alert. And it was just one of those things where she could tell you, you know, what the weather was like in 1976 on whatever day you say. And I get a call at like 6:30 in the morning from my aunt, and she's crying, and she's like, oh, Grandma lost her mind. So we go to the hospital to see her, and I'm like, hi, Grandma. And she, you know, she loves me, so she always, you know, hi, Shaney. And first thing, she just looks at me, and she goes, Charles, why are you here? It was just, you know, just really weird. And of course, we were all worried, and she couldn't remember anything. And then, you know, we'd tell her my dad's name, and she'd be like, oh, Wayne, yeah. 2 minutes later, she's like, I don't know Wayne. I don't have any children. Why are you all here? And yeah, about, you know, like you said, in 24 hours, she was back to normal. She didn't remember anything about that day and just moved on like it never happened. But yeah,
it was so weird with my grandmother because she recognized everybody. She recognized me. She recognized everybody who was at the hospital. She recognized the people that had brought her in. But she couldn't remember anything. Like, her short-term memory was completely gone. They took her in for the CAT scan, and they brought her back. And the moment they brought her back, we're like, how was the CAT scan? She couldn't even remember she just had a CAT scan. But she remembered all of us, and she had a lot of memories of things that had happened in the past and things that she did. But she couldn't remember. There was one story I didn't tell. She couldn't remember who the president was. They were quizzing her on things that anybody should know. And they were like, who is the president right now? And she goes, I don't remember. And so I was trying to keep her spirits up. She was in a good mood. But I was like, Granny, the answer is not Lincoln. And she looks at me and she goes, is it Taft? And then she starts laughing uproariously at her own joke that it might be William Henry Taft or whatever his name was. And so she had a sense of humor, and she was laughing about everything, but she couldn't remember a thing. It was the craziest. And by the next day, totally good as new.
Yeah, same thing with mine. She doesn't like my mom, or she didn't like my mom. She passed away now, but she doesn't like my mom at all. And my mom comes in and starts talking to her, and she just looks at everybody. She goes, who's this ugly woman talking to me?
Wow.
Wow.
Well, how about?
Thanks, Brian. I'm glad you're doing okay, man.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for the call. William Howard Taft, by the way, everybody, was the 27th president of the United States. Did I say William Harold Taft? What did I say? Anyway, one way or the other, Taft is not the current president of the United States. And then the next day, she's in the hospital just because they wanted to hold her for at least 24 hours just to make sure that she was all right. And I went to visit her, and they had just come in to do the memory test, which they do. And by the way, they did run every conceivable test on my grandmother. They did the CAT scan. They did the MRI. And the good news is she's remarkably healthy. Like the doctor, afterwards he goes, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. Aside from the transient global amnesia, of course, but very, very healthy. But she's in the hospital, and I went in there. They'd just given her the memory test, and she passed this memory test with flying colors. There was no stroke. There was no nothing. And I just remember thinking, I'll bet you anything that if they told me to take this memory test right now, I would be in that hospital for at least 24 hours under observation because I would have done very, very poorly on that thing. To the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
It's Dave from Wisconsin.
What's up, Dave?
Well, I guess two things now. After listening to the last caller, I just remember from the granny story from, a week ago now, you mentioned that she had a bunch of presents in her house. Did she put those there?
Yes, I didn't clear. I apologize if you listened to the show last night. I did not clarify that, everybody. My grandmother had called around. She called my aunt because she said somebody had broken into her house and put Christmas presents and flowers everywhere. And so that's when we figured out something must be wrong. And so my aunt called everybody and she said, did you go over to Granny's and leave presents? And nobody had. And so what happened was these were all Granny's presents. They were her own presents and they were her own flowers. And so when my aunt went over there and she's asking Granny what's going on, Granny is pointing at all of these presents that she has clearly put out and labeled and everything. And Granny is thinking that somebody broke in and put these presents here. And they're trying to convince her that, no, these are your presents. And she was completely confused. And that's when they called 911. So, yes, they were her own presents.
Okay. I was just curious about that because that wasn't really resolved. But the other thing I wanted to talk about was since it is Friday and thankfully for H2, they air Ancient Aliens Marathon pretty much all throughout the night. So that's basically what consumed most of my Friday. And I was just getting to think, they were talking about the SETI program and sending messages out into space. And I was just curious what your, if you have a moral dilemma with just our scientists basically sending messages out into space to try and communicate with extraterrestrials and knowing that they might be able to get to us and we really can't get to them, and the fear about, potential alien invasion a la Independence Day or whatever, the day the Earth stood still or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I don't know if I have a moral dilemma with it. I don't know if a moral dilemma would be the proper term, but...
Well, I mean, here's the thing that I came up with was just like, Say a group of even 100 scientists with a powerful radio telescope sending messages out into space basically gives an address to Earth, and a malicious superpower, intergalactic superpower, comes and says, hey, we're going to colonize and steal your resources and basically enslave you / kill you. And this is all just because somebody was like, hey, we wanted to explore the universe. And they've basically screwed everyone up.
I could be wrong about this, but I believe Stephen Hawking has suggested that we do not send out signals for the very reason that you said. And Michio Kaku...
He said something similar to that, yeah.
Yeah, Michio Kaku made a good point that because of the way the food chain works, if there are other civilizations out there that are highly advanced, they are predators. It's just the way things are. So... yeah, if there is another civilization out there that would like to take over and colonize a very beautiful planet like ours, and they don't care one bit about the beings living on the planet, then yes, this could be bad news. I'm an optimist, and I could be very naive, and I could be a fool, but I think that by the time that we, as a planet, have the ability to travel to other star systems, we can travel to other galaxies, we can do what we imagine these aliens doing. By the time we've achieved that level of technology, if we have not destroyed ourselves in this Earth, we will probably be a rather peaceful planet. And I'm hoping that that is the case with other alien civilizations around the universe. If they are, I don't know. You're either going to destroy yourselves or you'll reach a level of civilization that you're no longer in danger of killing yourselves and so you live in peace. So hopefully that is the case and we will not just have some alien civilization out there that decides they want to come and devour our planet.
All right, fair enough. I just thought I'd pick your brain on that because that was something I was just bouncing around my brain while I was watching earlier tonight.
It is something to be concerned about, but I mean, humans still we for the most part we attempt to take care of what we feel are the more intelligent animals. You know, we eat meat, we eat cows, we eat chickens, but we don't eat cats, dogs, animals that we feel are higher on the intelligence scale. And so I would hope that if there were another civilization out there that came to this planet, they would see us on a level of intelligence high enough that they would not enslave and or eat us. But I don't know. I'm an optimist,
Dave. Well, we did enslave ourselves. We did enslave humans for around, well, until about, what, 100 years ago?
Yeah, we did. And at the time, all we could do was sail in boats and have horse-drawn carriages. As our technology has advanced, we've, at least in the civilized world, done much less enslavement.
Fair enough.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the call. I hope that I'm right, but I don't know. What do you think? Should we be broadcasting signals out into space? God knows who might be picking them up. God knows how hungry they might be. My bigger concern is not so much that we're beaming out all of this information, but for example, we're sending out radio signals, television signals, and that sort of thing. And when you look at how long the Earth has been here, even if you believe the Earth has only been around for 6,000 years, it's still a blink of an eye. If you believe the Earth has been here for billions of years, which it has, in my opinion, then clearly the amount of time that we've had a radio and television signals is less than the blink of an eye. So, where will we be in 100 years? Will we still be broadcasting television and radio signals? How will we be watching our entertainment? Maybe we won't even be using radio and television signals anymore. So maybe we're beaming out signals that are so amazingly primitive to whoever we are expecting to pick them up that they would never even think of trying to pick up a radio signal because it will be such ancient technology to them. And maybe at that time, they will believe that if there is another civilization out there, that civilization will be using whatever communication and broadcast technology they're using on their planet. Who knows? But radio and television signals, I don't know. I don't know how effective that's going to be. And if you believe SETI and any other scientific organization who is not sitting here saying we've been visited by aliens... if you believe them, then apparently it hasn't worked out very well at all. Because we've had no communication with anybody. nor have we picked up any signals. And again, if we're scanning the skies looking for radio signals, is this the best way to try to pick up information from a civilization which may not even be using radio and hasn't used radio for thousands, tens of thousands, millions of years, if they are that advanced? It is interesting when you look at some of the ways that SETI is now trying to determine if there is life elsewhere, such as looking at heat signatures of planets, or, for example, if you look at the Earth at night, it is lit up in the dark areas because of we light up the world at night. The moon, obviously, is not lit up at night if you were to go to the dark side of the moon. So maybe there is a way when telescopes get powerful enough, perhaps they will be able to see planets orbiting stars and find out if those planets are in fact lit up at night, which would be an indication that somebody's there. Or I can't remember who was on the show, but they were talking about heat signatures of the planets. They would be able to determine whether the heat coming off of a planet was naturally generated heat, or if it was heat as a result of lighting up the world at night. So there are many different ways to try to determine if there is life on other planets that does not require searching for radio signals or television signals or something that may be very antiquated on whatever civilization we're trying to communicate with. So I think as time goes by, we'll find even other better ideas to try to find out if there is life on other planets other than searching for signals. We're going to head to our interview right now. Christopher Keegan is about to be on the show. He is an actor, a professional actor in the UK. He does stage plays, stage work, and he has been to many, many theaters where strange phenomenon has been reported. Ghost stories, sightings, physical manifestations, and so much more. It's going to be a very interesting show tonight. If you're interested in ghosts and this sort of phenomenon, this will be the show for you. So we will be back in just a moment with Christopher Keegan here on After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio Show on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Very happy tonight to be joined by Chris Keegan, who has got a lot to talk about today in terms of ghosts and hauntings from across the pond, as they say. Chris, how are you doing tonight?
Not too bad, thank you, Brian. A little bit late over here, as you say, over the pond, but very happy to be on the show.
That's right. I love when we have somebody from across the pond on the show because it adds a little bit of class to this otherwise classless program here.
You're very kind.
That's right. Now, we got a lot to talk about here. For those that don't know Chris Keegan, why don't you give everybody a little bit of a bio about yourself, and then we'll get into talking about some theater hauntings.
Yes, certainly. I grew up in a small town in the north of Yorkshire called Hebden Bridge. Not very well-known place, but a very beautiful place. I moved down to London about 2006, it was now, to train as an actor at a university called Drama Centre London. I graduated there in 2009, and I've been working professionally as an actor in television, theatre, and film ever since.
Now, obviously, I wanted to get you on the show not just to talk ghosts and your own experiences, but very, very soon here, probably in a week or two, I am going to be doing my own ghost investigation. And it is not a haunted theater, but it is a very, very, very old building. And there have been some strange reports of people seeing things, feeling things, and that sort of deal. So hopefully we can get a little bit of perspective from you here. And of course, I am in Seattle, and so there are all sorts of haunted theaters everywhere. Let's start by talking a little bit about some of your experiences. How many theaters have you worked in during your career, and do you have a number, a percentage maybe, of how many have some sort of strange story about them?
How many theaters have I worked in? That is a good question. Many, many, many. I haven't been working professionally for an excessively large amount of time, considering some actors work their entire lives. It's not really a profession that you can actually retire from, really. But I have done many UK tours where I have been touring for about 6 months and work in a different theatre each week. You tend to work Monday to Saturday and then Sunday as your travel day. So add that up. There are quite a few regional theatres in the UK, and most of them have some form of story, some form of haunting. The most prolific of the stories are in London, because London has some of the oldest theatres. The oldest one, which I will talk a little bit about tonight, being built originally in 1663, which is quite a while ago. And
it's much older than the building that I'm looking at here.
Well, yes, I say England being a slightly older country than America, of course.
That's right.
The theatre in question is called the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane, and probably is one of the most haunted, well, it's probably the most haunted theatre in the world, if the stories, of course, are to be believed. Could very well be one of the most haunted buildings in the world.
Now, were you interested in this sort of topic? Did you have an interest in ghosts before you got into acting and just sort of, wow, here I am in this profession and everywhere I go or many of the places I go have some sort of story? Or did you have no interest in this whatsoever and you just found through the course of doing all of this that, man, there are a lot of haunted theaters here in this country?
I've always been interested in ghost stories ever since I was very, very young. In fact, I remember there was a book in my local library called, I think it was called something like The Osborne Book Mysteries of the Unknown, I believe it was. And it was all about UFOs and hauntings and monsters. And I loved that book. I absolutely loved it. And I read it cover to cover. And then I started, drifting into, novelizations that were based around ghosts. One particularly which caught my attention when I was young was called The Darkness Behind the Curtain, which is all about a group of kids at school doing a production of Sweeney Todd. And they got so into their characters and the show that they awoke the ghosts of Victorian children who essentially plotted to kill the lead actor. And I, again, adored that book. And my sort of love of the stories continued all the way through my life, and that flourished into the want to do acting, which, you know, for me is just about telling stories, and ghost stories among them is a real passion of mine.
Let's start with a classic ghost story of the type that you have experienced. It can be maybe one of your favorites, or it can be something that you feel is a typical example of what one would hear about in terms of a theater haunting in the UK.
Okay. I think some of the most interesting ghost stories in the UK start from the actual lives of the people that are meant to haunt these theaters. One of the things I find most interesting about the ghosts which are meant to haunt theaters in particular is their backstory, which is most of the time exceptionally factual and can be traced back in parish records, and these days, of course, is widely available on the internet. Let's talk a little bit about the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane. As I was talking earlier, one of the most haunted theatres in Britain, is home to several ghosts, the most famous being a gentleman by the name of Joseph Grimaldi. Joseph Grimaldi was an actor and performer in the 1800s. He was a singer, a dancer, a clown, an entertainer. He was the origin, or one of the origins, of the Harlequin character, which pops up quite a lot in theatre. Particular in the UK, we have a Christmas tradition called pantomime, which is a play, usually a nursery story like Peter Pan or Jack and the Beanstalk. And there are certain traditions that go along with that. There's always a man in drag, but it's usually someone you would not expect. It's usually someone with quite a deep voice. And there are certain gags and audience participation that go along with that. Grimaldi was one of the people that started the tradition of pantomime in the UK, and he was essentially a clown. However, many, many years of tumbling, which is one of the things he did in his act, ravaged his body, and he had to retire in about 1823. He had a very a rocky relationship with his son, who eventually died. When his son died, he reverted to alcoholism, as is you'll find quite often with actors, especially the actors in the ghost stories we're going to talk about. He actually, after his son died, him and his wife Mary made a suicide pact, and they actually attempted to take poison together. Unfortunately, they didn't do a very good job of it and just ended up with bad stomachs for a couple of days. When he was found dead in his bed, the doctor noted on his death certificate that he had died by the visitation of God. And that is an absolute fact. That death certificate can still be found.
Was this confirmed by God, or who confirmed this fact?
Apparently so. It was the doctor's diagnosis that he had died by the visitation of God. So I suppose it's sort of an open book as to what killed him, although I'm probably inclined to believe that it was the alcohol that eventually ended his life.
I hope somebody puts that on my death certificate, by the way. Everybody listening to this right now, make sure that happens if I pass away of natural causes. Death
died
via
visitation
of God. That's right.
Well, I mean, also, as he died, apparently his last wishes were that his head should be severed from his body prior to burial.
That I'm not down with, just for the
record. I know, me neither. And if you believe the stories, that is what happened. His last wishes were, in fact, adhered to, and his head was severed from his body. Now, he's rumored to haunt the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, which is where he did the majority of his pantomimes and where he did some of his most famous shows. He has cropped up numerous times throughout the years in this theatre. However, what he's most famous for is giving actors on stage a bit of a kick, which was, in fact, one of the jokes that he would do as his Harlequin character would be to kick other characters in the pants, basically. And rumor has it, and there are a number of people who've reported this over the years, that if you are on stage and as a performer you are not in your light, meaning the audience cannot see you, you'll get a bit of a kick from Grimaldi, which will actually force you into your light so that people will be able to see your performance.
Now, many, many, many questions here. First off, I don't know if you've heard this show of late, but a couple of weeks ago we talked about phantom clowns, and we got into this big discussion about clowns. A lot of people in this country are terrified of clowns. There's a phobia named after it. What is the feeling in the UK in terms of clowns? Are clowns as feared as they are here in the United States? Has that changed over the decades? Was a clown a horrifying or a tragic character back in the 1800s? Or, I guess, how would you describe what people thought of his clown character?
His clown character was very much loved. A lot of the actors over the years that performed in these pantomimes, these Christmas pantomimes, developed these clown-like characters, and they were adored for them. One, in fact, who I will talk about in a bit, called Dan Leno, at one point received a telegram from the King congratulating him on such a wonderful performance. They were the celebrities of their day. They were absolutely adored. The clowns that we see today that strike such a paralyzing fear into the hearts of many are not the clowns that have evolved from this type of performer. This type of performance has now evolved into not quite as grotesque as the clowns you imagine turning up at your five-year-old's party. They are more figures of fun who have a knowledge that the audience have, but the other characters on stage don't. If you look at such Shakespearean pieces as You Like It, there's a character called Touchstone who is a jester, a clown, and he is pretty much the only other character on the stage, apart from the audience, who knows what's really going on. And that, especially in the 1800s, was the impression of clowns. They were loved. They were the comic relief, and they were usually the actors that everyone came to see.
Now, I have seen some photos of masks that have been used in theater that clowns have used over the years, and sometimes I look at them, and it's very creepy and terrifying. And I guess the question is it creepy and terrifying because of how we view clowns today? Were these masks? Did they wear masks? What did he wear? Was it considered strange?
Grimaldi particularly favored white face paint. In fact, he was one of the people that inspired the white face paint that you will see on clowns today. He, rather than big red lips, perhaps a teardrop from the eye, as you'll see today, he would exaggerate his features a little bit. He'd add extra lines, black lines to the white makeup to age himself, or draw raised eyebrows on his forehead to indicate a surprised character. They were archetypes, and I think that's probably where we find it from today. It's, I suppose it's something that I suppose scientists have called the Uncanny Valley, something that appears almost human-like but is not quite right, that sort of puts the chills into us.
Yes. Now, in this country, we hear about a lot of hauntings in places where, for example, a murder took place, or some sort of horrible suicide, or an insane asylum, for example, places where terrible things have happened. And, you know, you mentioned the suicide pact in the story of Grimaldi, and we're going to tell more stories here, but it would seem that in the theater, why would there be, and it's the same thing here in this country, there are a lot of haunted theaters. What is it, do you feel, about the theaters that causes souls, so to speak, to stay here on the earth?
I would say performers themselves have a habit of being wanting to be the center of attention. Actors have a habit of name-dropping, of wanting to tell their story. It's one of the reasons why I got into acting. I love stories of every shape and size. And one could postulate that some actors, some performers, have difficulty letting go. I know some actors who are alive today who have difficulty letting go of parts they played 20, 30 years ago. It's very possible that some actors want to cling on that a little bit longer.
Do you feel it has something to do with strong passions for the theater? Is it a... Are there certain people that are drawn to the theater that maybe have stronger personalities, something of that nature?
I think that's a very true statement to make, certainly. There is something addictive about performing in front of a live audience. Performance today, and acting particularly, has evolved into things as the internet and television and, of course, film. But there's just something about a live audience which is addictive, and it just makes you want to keep coming back. I would never want to give up stage acting. It is something that is rooted deep inside me. And I haven't met very many actors who have said, oh, do you know what? I don't want to do stage acting. I only want to perform in front of a camera. To have an audience applaud for you and hang on your every word is it's like nothing else. It really isn't. And if it were to be the case, I would say that would keep people hanging on. It's the desire to get things right as well. If you haven't lived a life which has ended the way you wanted it to, the desire to want to keep going could very well be overpowering.
So how often do we have Grimaldi sightings? What are some of the more famous legends based around him?
Grimaldi, his story is told quite often. And if you go to the Theatre Royal in Drury Lane these days, you can get a tour where they will tell you a lot of the stories about him. The most common stories seem to be a showgirl who was kicked forward out of her dancing line. I believe that would have been just after the Second World War. He has also been rumored to appear in mirrors in dressing rooms, which...
Oh, man, come on.
Yeah, that is not the sort of thing that I would like to see, especially when I'm getting ready for a show.
In the makeup, it's even worse.
I know. And also, his severed head, apparently, is reported occasionally floating in front of the actor's eyes as they're performing.
Honest to God, I'd be less concerned about that than the form in the mirror.
That is certainly not something that I want to see. You know, the last thing you want to be doing is putting your own makeup on, maybe a mascara, whatever it might be, looking up, and then seeing the white face of Joseph Grimaldi and all his clown makeup standing behind you. Not something I'm looking forward to, if that ever were to happen to me, of course.
We did have a incident in the building that I'm going to be investigating, where somebody was just kind of sitting down, and they felt like somebody slapped them on the back, and they turned around, nobody there. There was nobody there. And he was very concerned about this, obviously. And it's interesting when you hear ghost stories, sometimes you hear about there's sounds that are made, someone has seen something, something wispy, whatever it might be. But it is very strange to think about physical manifestations and something actually being able to make contact with you.
Definitely, definitely. And there is another haunting at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, a man by the name of Dan Leno. And the way he manifests himself is a lavender smell, which I have actually smelt myself when doing a tour of the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. Very, very strange. He's also reported to practice his clog dancing routine in one of the dressing rooms, which is even weirder.
So sounds and smells are some of the common manifestations of these things.
Very much so, very much so. Although actual physical sightings are equally as common, especially in the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. In fact, in 1848, there was a renovation of the theatre, and in the upper circle, they were tearing down a couple of walls, and they discovered, and this is absolutely true, a hidden chamber. And inside the hidden chamber was a skeleton with a knife stuck into the ribs.
Wow.
Absolutely true. This theatre has a very, very long and detailed history. And occasionally, actors and performers on the stage have reported to look up into the upper circle and have seen a man dressed in grey in a tri-corner hat sitting and watching the performances. And it has also been said that he will shush loud theatregoers if they're making too much noise during a performance.
It's another one I really don't like is the phantoms wearing hats. That seems to be I've read about different, I guess, reports of the Hat Man, as it's called around here. And it seems like the Hat Man is making a comeback. And something about the hat that really bothers people. And again, I don't really know why, but it does.
I suppose the certainly the tri-corner hat, it would stand out. It's not something that you would see every day. And if you were to see it, would draw your attention. You know, it's not often you'll see someone sitting in the back of a theatre wearing a tri-corner hat. And then I suppose if you were to go to a stage manager afterwards and ask who the patron was, you would no doubt hear the story of the man with the tri-corner hat.
Now, is it usually only the performers and the actors that have these experiences, or do the patrons of the theater sometimes report that they have seen, heard, smelled, or felt something?
The patrons quite often, actually. There's quite a famous story. Actually, I think it was in the BBC. It was reported by the BBC not too long ago. There is a theater in Bristol called the Bristol Old Vic, and the architect was doing a renovation of the theater. This was not too long ago now. I think it was 2010. And he was walking up some stairs at the back of the theater, and right in front of him, he saw the apparition of a woman he believed to be a 200-year-old woman called Sarah McGrady, who was the theater manager. And apparently she smiled at him quite genially and vanished. And he was reported as saying to the BBC that he felt that that was her approving of the renovation works that were going on at the theater.
So she'd also been gone for 200 years. She didn't physically look like she was 200 years old. Because if that's the case,
no.
I need a detailed report.
Yes, of course. No, apparently she looked about the age she was when she died, which I believe was about 30 or 40 years old.
Hmm.
And there's quite a famous photo that did the rounds on the internet not too long ago, which, whether one believes it or not, is up for debate. Photos being very easy to doctor these days, of course. But the photo was taken at the Dominion Theatre in Tottenham Court Road, which is where We Will Rock You has been on for many, many years, the Queen musical. And the theatre is interesting, as it was originally the site of a pub called the Tavistock Arms, And opposite the pub on the other side of the road, there was a brewery. Now, I don't know, Brian, whether you've ever heard of the Great London Beer Flood.
I have not.
No. Not as fun as it sounds, though, I must say.
Well, I hate beer, so it sounds no fun at all.
Oh, very good. Well, yes. I am a fan of beer, but I'm afraid to be flooded by it does not sound fun at all. It happened on the 17th of October in, I think it was 1814. One of the vats of beer in the brewery opposite the Tavistock Arms burst, causing, I think it was over 100,000 gallons of beer burst into this brewery, causing a chain reaction to break all the other vats. And what that meant was over 300,000 gallons of beer burst out of the doors and windows of this brewery into the street. It flooded across the street and started smashing into the walls of the Tavistock Arms pub. It ended up actually breaking down some of the walls and flooding into the cellar of the brewer of the pub. There was a 15 or 16 year old girl, one of the barmaids at the pub, called Eleanor Cooper, who was in the basement. She was changing out some of the barrels, and some of the rubble pinned her to the floor. And the beer rushed in, and she unfortunately drowned to death. Drowned to death, I don't know whether that's exactly a phrase, but she drowned nevertheless in beer, not as fun. She's reported to be haunting the Dominion Theatre, and this photo that was taken relatively recently is of two theatregoers taking a selfie, as I believe it's called, and between them is the face of a very grisly-looking young girl.
Where can I find this photo?
It exists online. You'll be able to find it. If you search for Eleanor Cooper, no doubt she will pop up.
Eleanor Cooper. I will do that. Now, is it mostly adults that are seeing ghosts, or are there children that are seen as well?
As far as I'm aware, Eleanor Cooper is the only child to have appeared in a theatre as a ghost. I haven't come across very many. It tends to be fully grown performers who have met their end in some way, either connected to the theatre or connected around it. That tends to be the way. In fact, it does tend to be a lot of men. I've not very many female ghosts that I found on my travels, as it were.
Looking for this selfie right now. I will keep you updated. When we were talking about this selfie and this ghost photo, do we have a lot of photographs and videos? I'm not sure exactly how it works in the theater. I mean, I would presume they'll tell you no flash photography, no videotaping, that sort of thing. So I would guess that there probably would be less video and photo than you would think. I mean, these people, it sounds like they were in the lobby taking the selfie. But is there a lot of footage and video of these strange things, or is it mostly just eyewitness accounts?
Mostly eyewitness accounts. You find with, especially some of the long-running theaters, there are people who are there for many, many years. Working for a theater can be a wonderful, wonderful thing and offer quite a good deal of job security. One of the primary roles backstage is the stage doorkeeper, the man who guards the door where the actors come in and out and makes people stand outside and wait for photographs and autographs. The stage doorkeeper, from my experience, has always been the best place to find the ghost stories. They usually know all the ins and outs of the theater, and they tend to know all the stories. In terms of photographic evidence and video evidence, not a huge amount, really. Although there was a report, it was a couple of years ago, there is a show that is running in London at the moment called Ghost Stories, and it is showing in a Leicester Square theatre. It's not based around factual events, as far as I'm aware. It's sort of a scare tactic show, as it were. But it was a couple of years ago, they released some CCTV footage of some strange happenings going on inside the theatre at night, and they actually advertised asking for someone to stay the night in the theatre and report back their findings. As far as I'm aware, no one actually volunteered, although myself and a friend of mine, Phil, we have considered reaching out to them and spending the night and seeing what happens.
Well, if you do, we need to have you back on the show for a report. I have found this photo, and I'm going to tweet this out to the world here. When you described it, I've seen a lot of ghost pictures in my lifetime, and usually there's nothing to see. It's just like you see some sort of wispiness or something like that. This actually made me jump a little when I opened up this photo. I don't know what that is, but that thing is creepy. There is, in fact, there are these two. There's two folks, a male and a female. They're putting their heads together, and they are taking a selfie. And in fact, there is a face, an unmistakable, terrifying face, right in between. You know, their foreheads are touching, and so there's a gap between their cheeks, basically. And there, in fact, is a. It's blue. This face is blue. This thing is horrifying.
It is. It's very Exorcist-esque, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't even know, like, because of the size of it, it doesn't even appear possible that it could be a person.
Yeah.
The head is just too small. It's not even like there could be somebody way behind them or something like that. It's a very freaky photo.
It's rather unnerving, yeah. I'm not a fan of it myself. It put the willies up me when I saw it for the first time.
The funniest part about it is whoever has posted this on londonparanormal.com, and if you want to go up there, it's up at London Paranormal if you haven't seen it on my Twitter yet, but somebody has drawn a red circle around it as well as an arrow and the words ghost. As if you could possibly not see it. It's unmistakable and right in the middle of the frame.
Yeah, sort of unnecessary to point it out because it really does smack you in the face as soon as you look at the photograph. It really
yes,
does.
It does. God, that thing is horrifying. All right, well, any other good photos I can look up now?
Do you know what? I'm not entirely sure photographs. That was the only one I found that sort of claims to be evidence of a haunting. I say most of these hauntings tend to happen backstage or on stage.
Sure.
Very rarely do you find that they're happening to audience members. They do tend to happen to actors quite more often than audience members or staff members in the theatre quite frequently as well. I mean, particularly with that in the Dominion Theatre where Eleanor Cooper is reported to haunt, staff members frequently report mysterious bangs and crashes, and more unnerving than anything else, the giggle of an unknown girl. However, if I drowned in a vat of beer, I might not be giggling.
No, absolutely not. If you're listening to this, by the way, on a replay, everybody, we're talking to Christopher Keegan here, and if you want to find the photo and you can't find it on my Twitter, I believe I Googled Eleanor. What did I do? What's her name again?
Eleanor Cooper.
Eleanor Cooper ghost is what I put in, and it's the second photo that comes up, so it's pretty much impossible to miss. So head up there to Google and check it out. So you mentioned the possibility of you doing some sort of investigation into a haunted theater. Have there been other investigations here in the U.S.? I don't know how closely you follow it or what's available in the U.K., but we have all of these wacky shows, Ghost Hunters, and there's always somebody going out looking for some haunting in some place. We've got all of these organizations, TV shows on all the time. Are there a lot of investigations over there in the U.K.? Do people largely attempt to leave these spirits alone? What is the Ghost Hunter update from the UK?
There is not really a huge amount of investigation that I'm aware of. We do have a television show in the UK called Most Haunted, which is quite a well-known, long-running television program where they essentially go into haunted buildings or reported haunted buildings, switch all the lights off, switch on the night vision, and try and communicate with ghosts. It has mixed reviews. Sometimes nothing happens. Sometimes there will be a loud noise, but later on in the program, it'll be revealed that one of the cameramen dropped his mug of coffee. But they have visited the Drury Theatre, the Drury Lane Theatre. Now, I haven't actually seen that episode, unfortunately. But in terms of actually hunting out theatre ghosts, there's not really a big culture of that, to be honest. I would say we more tend to leave them alone and tell their stories.
It seems to me that I always watch these shows, and, you know, finding Bigfoot, for example, it's always a night expedition. They've come to the conclusion that these things only come out at night. And obviously, when you're doing a ghost hunting episode, it's the same thing. It's always in the middle of the night. You turn off all the lights. You make it as dark as possible. You use night vision. But it does seem to me, from some of the stories you're telling, that a lot of these sightings are seen, maybe not in daylight because you're inside a theater, but lights are on. You're getting ready for a performance. It's a well-lit area. It's not necessarily in the middle of the night. They seem to come out whenever they want to come out.
Exactly, yeah. It's in fact, there's quite a well-documented case of an attack on an actress by a ghost as she was getting ready for a show.
An attack.
Now, the details of that attack remain a mystery. The ghost in question was an actor by the name of William Terrace, who was another actor from the late 1800s. He was a performer at a theatre called the Adelphi Theatre, which is in Covent Garden in London. He played the romantic young leads, the swashbuckling pioneer Romeo. He was very much loved and very much adored by the theatre-going public. He was also a very generous man, reached out a lot to young actors and struggling actors. One of the actors he reached out to is a man called Richard Archer Prince, a fiendish name if I've ever heard one. He was an actor who was, again, an alcoholic and very much down on his luck. William Terrace had helped him out on many occasions financially and in terms of acting roles as well. If Terrace was in a production and there was a small part going, he could recommend Prince. Prince, it was December in 1897. Prince went to the Adelphi Theatre where William Terrace was performing. Terrace would perform against his leading lady, a woman called Jessie Millward, who was also his lover at the time. And Prince managed to sweet-talk his way into the theatre and confronted Terrace backstage. Terrace basically denied his request for money and sent him on his way. As Terrace was leaving the stage door at the end of the performance, Richard Arthur Prince came up behind him and stabbed him once in the back, twice in the chest, and then punched him to the ground before disappearing into the night. He was taken into the theatre, this is Terrace, and he was taken into the dressing room of Jessie Millward, and it is reported that just before he died, he whispered into her ear, "I will be back," which, as I'm sure you would agree, is rather ominous.
Man.
I know.
Must you?
I'm simply reporting what my research has led me to.
I will be back.
I will be back. I know. I would have preferred him to say something like, "This will not be my last performance," possibly a little bit more fitting. But
actually, now that I think about it, those are some pretty good last words.
I will be back, yes.
I got to remember that.
He has been reported to have knocked on Millward's door. Now, this is apparently quite a regular occurrence, knocking on the door of his lost lover. But there was a report in the 1920s of an actress, I believe her name was June, or I think it was June or Julie.
June or July?
June as in the month of June, yes. She reported that she was attacked in her dressing room, which was the dressing room of Jessie Millward, by the ghost of William Terrace. Now, exactly what happened, no detail has really been gone into, but...
But how did she make this report without telling people exactly what the attack consisted of?
Well, it was her screams that brought the other cast members to the dressing room.
Sure, but then when they interviewed her, she just was like, "I don't know what happened."
Do you know, I haven't found any actual reports of... from the event. And this did only happen in the 1920s as well, so this wasn't that long ago. There are no actual reports. As far as I can see, she never actually made any official report. I mean, why would you go to the police to report the attack of a ghost?
Sure.
It's not likely they can arrest them. But
you can't really make a wanted poster for that ghost.
Exactly, yeah. You can't go Googling them to try and find out where they live. She did say that she believed she had been attacked because she was in the dressing room of Jessie Millward, and he believed that she shouldn't have been there.
Hmm. I would presume the typical hair pulling, that sort of thing. We just don't know.
A knockdown, drag out fight.
That's right.
With William Terrace.
Now, you, we've been talking a little bit about various investigations. You mentioned earlier that at one point, and I believe it was at the Theater Royal, maybe it wasn't, I can't remember, but you had smelled lavender. Was it at that theater?
That's right, yes.
So what kind of having done a lot of stage performances, having been in a lot of theaters with a lot of stories, what kind of personal experiences have you had?
Not as many as I'd like. I really haven't had any supernatural experiences myself. I have been fascinated by the stories and the background of these people and how these backgrounds have been woven into these stories, which are told over and over again to explain these strange events happening in these incredibly old buildings. The closest I have come is the smell of lavender. I went to the Theatre Royal Drury Lane to go on their tour, which I can recommend to anyone who is in London. There's a wonderful woman called Imogen who does the tour there. She's a fountain of knowledge. We were walking around, and she was explaining the stories, and she and I began to smell the smell of lavender. Didn't think much of it, as I hadn't actually heard the story of Dan Leno, who is the story where the lavender smell comes from. And sure enough, about 5 minutes later into the tour, she told the story of Dan Leno, who is another unfortunate character as far as acting goes. He played the pantomime dame in the theatre at Drury Lane. The pantomime dame, as I said before, is the actor who appears in drag. Now it's usually very deliberate bad drag, so you know it's a gentleman. And the whole purpose of the dame is to provide low comedy. These actors are beloved, they really are, but not often taken very seriously, as was the case with unfortunate Dan Leno. He, again, once again, and you'll see a pattern reoccurring here, reverted to alcoholism, and that caused him to become incontinent, and he would mask his incontinence with lavender powder, and that, apparently, is the smell that can still be smelt occasionally when walking around the theatre. Now, at the time, no one else in my party could smell lavender. It was just me. So maybe I have some sort of connection with other performers passed beyond this mortal coil. I'm not sure.
It does seem to be a lot of alcoholism. And you, by the way, before we get into that, it is funny that you mentioned that you have not had any of these experiences, but you would like to, because I'm sure that many people who have had these experiences, and obviously there are many people whose houses they claim to be haunted, a poltergeist activity, all these people want is to not have these experiences, and now you're asking for them.
I would like the story, Brian, basically. My life is about stories, always has been. I collect them, as it were. I love telling stories, my stories, other people's stories, and to have an experience of the supernatural would be a fantastic story. Plus, it would make me a fully fledged believer as well. At this point, I adore hearing all of these tales and hearing about all these people and these experiences. But I find it hard personally to truly and 100% believe unless I have experienced it myself.
I'm very much in your boat. I've never experienced anything. I've heard plenty of stories. My dad has experienced something. This building we're going to, people there have experienced things. I've never experienced anything. And so there's always skepticism. I tend to believe that something's going on, because I know my buddy who got slapped in the back, I know this guy. He's not making up this story. And in terms of stories that I've heard from the building, I have heard stories from different people who didn't tell others, and there was no legend of the haunted building, so to speak. Somebody came up to me and they told me about the window was open and there was like a rush of air and the buildings rattled and there was no reason for it. And then later somebody else told me another story and I said, you know, did you hear from this first person? Oh, no, I had no idea that happened. They're shocked that someone else has had an experience. So it's not like they're talking amongst each other and that sort of thing. And I believe these people. I don't know if it's a ghost. I don't know if there's just some sort of natural phenomenon that causes these things to happen. I don't know. But if I experienced it, like you said, maybe then I would believe.
There are some things that that happen that are hard to quantify. Again, people who you would have absolutely no problem trusting or believing having an experience that they cannot explain. And those are the people that I tend to believe more than people that come back and say, I saw a ghost, it was disembodied, it was flying here, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
The people that come back and say, I saw something, but I have no idea what it was. That is more compelling evidence for me than someone who will come back and say, I saw a monster, I saw a UFO, I saw a ghost. Something that can't be explained, that leaves a lot more open questions.
Now, a topic that we have discussed a lot in this show, because Christmas is coming, and so all of the paranormal sites have all of the articles of late about sales of the Ouija board in the U.S., and all of these kids are getting Ouija boards, and who knows what they might be conjuring up. Even though, as is noted in other articles, Ouija boards are sold every year, and the world has not come to an end. What are your thoughts on the Ouija board? And as somebody who would like to have an experience, have you ever considered experimenting with a Ouija board to see what you can see?
I have not experimented with a Ouija board personally. I personally, thinking about it, I don't hold a huge amount of trust that the Ouija board is much more than a game, a child's game. When I was growing up, my mother showed me, I don't know whether you've tried it yourself, the pendulum trick, where you take a heavy object, a necklace, usually something that is relatively personal to yourself, and you hold it out in front of you until it starts swinging in a circle, be it anti-clockwise or clockwise, and you note which way it's swinging.
Wait. I've never heard about this, so now I need more details.
Have you never heard this?
No.
Well, this is what my mother taught me when I was very young. What you do is once this pendulum, or whether it be a necklace or whatever, is swinging in a certain direction.
So it swings on its own? You're just holding it out in front of you on a string and it just starts to spin?
Yes, a natural sort of spin, basically. It's hard. If you're holding your arm straight down in front of you, it's hard to keep something on a relatively long string still the entire time. Small circles or large circles, it doesn't matter, as long as it has some sort of movement. Once you've got a little bit of movement going in it, something you're not actively influencing, of course, you then ask the pendulum a series of yes or no questions, calibration questions. And the idea is that the pendulum will swing in one direction for yes and the other for no. And I had a lot of fun doing this as I was a child because it worked for me. And I found it mysterious.
Hold on a second. So it's spinning. Let's say it's spinning counterclockwise. And you ask it a yes or no question. Is that basically it?
That's basically it, yep.
Okay, so you ask it a yes question and it just keeps going. And then you ask it a question where the answer is no, and it just stops and starts spinning the other way?
It's a strange movement to describe. Basically, yeah, it's not a case of it just halting and then going in the other direction. It's almost as if the pendulum will sort of do a figure eight and then be swinging in the opposite direction. I encourage you to try it. I was just going to say,
there's people all over the place getting string out right now.
I'd love to hear the success and the failure stories from them, because when I was a kid, I thought it was wonderful. I thought it was magical. Nowadays, I'm rather more convinced that it is subconscious muscle movements. And that is, of course, if you're not trying to spin it. Now, there have been occasions, of course, where it just sits still. But 9 times out of 10, when I've done it, and it's been a few years since I have tried it, it has worked and it has been rather entertaining.
The pendulum trick.
Mm.
So you try this as a kid, and you had some success with this, but you've since determined that probably this was not spirits affecting the spin of whatever this object was.
That's correct, yeah, and I think the same thing holds with the Ouija board. I think if the other thing, of course, is if people really desperately want something to happen or really want something to move, then it'll move. Especially on a Ouija board, if they've got their hands on a central slider, as it were, and people want something to be spelt out or said, then it'll happen. whether you're convincing yourself that it's a spirit or whether it's you're convincing yourself that it's your own muscle movements. But in terms of if I were to, for example, take up the offer of the theatre in London, which is hoping for people to stay over the night, you know, I wouldn't be trying things as such as a Ouija board. I'd be using more high-tech things, recording equipment, trying to record as much audio as I could, and of course, video equipment, much of which, obviously, if you set up the video recorder and something strange appears on there, you can't really question it.
That's right. What other, since we're on the topic, what other spirit communication techniques or games are popular over there in the UK? Because I never heard of the pendulum game. Are there others like that?
Not that I can think of. Supernatural games and fortune telling, and not as popular over here as it used to be. I think the stereotype of the cynical Brit is still very much true to this day. There's not a huge amount of love for the paranormal over here anymore, although you will find it, certainly. I mean, the television program Most Haunted, there are lots of people who love the program, but it has been ridiculed and mocked in the public eye for quite some time. The want for the supernatural and the love for the supernatural seems to have gone out of the populace a little bit. But there's always a place for ghost stories. I myself did a play in Guernsey in the Channel Islands last year, which is a group of islands off the south of England. In fact, so south it's almost France. I did a play which was essentially a small collection of ghost stories from Guernsey, dramatized, and it was very well received. And, of course, the play The Woman in Black, which is on the West End at the moment, has been on the West End for many, many years and is one of the most terrifying live plays I have ever seen in my life. I can highly recommend it.
What's so terrifying about it?
The director and the performers have come up with a very, very good way of staging the show. And first of all, it's billed as a two-man show. It's based off a very, very terrifying horror book. And I believe there was a film out not a few years ago with Daniel Radcliffe, which certainly is not as good as the play. The play itself is essentially a two-man show, and it is about a man telling his story of what happened to him. And the set is not very popularized with props at all. In fact, the only real props are a couple of chairs and maybe a stack of paper or two. So the whole world is built up between these two actors. It's a very intimate space. And then, without wanting to ruin it, the play just suddenly turns on its head. There are perhaps a couple of what I would call shock jumps, but most of it is just insanely atmospheric. One moment in particular where one of the actors settles down to sleep, and he really does just lie down on the stage, and the auditorium just goes deadly quiet. There's nothing going on the stage. The lights are dimmed. It's a terrifying atmosphere to be in.
What is it about theater, as somebody who is very much involved in it, that leads so many to alcoholism?
Oh, now that's a good question. As anyone will know, if you follow the popular press, there have been and still are many, many reports over the years of actors, performers who abuse not only alcohol but drugs. I mean, you have to simply look at people like Heath Ledger a couple of years ago, and of course Philip Seymour Hoffman this year. It's hard to put a finger on it. I mean, I myself don't struggle with any sort of dependency, and I don't currently know any working actors who do, although I have come across a few in my time, mainly at when I was in training. Something to do with the aura, I suppose, that comes with being an actor, the idea of being an actor. It's bohemian, it's cool, for want of a better word, it's cool. and that side of it can go along with it. Plus, there is the other side of boredom as well, particularly with films. You can be on set for a very, very long time. You can have whole days where you wait in a little room in a trailer and you never get called. And I suppose depression, you're in the public eye a lot, especially if you reach that stage where you are recognizable. There's nowhere you can go without being recognized and being pointed out and being photographed. I can imagine, you know, luckily I'm certainly not at that level, but I can imagine that being thoroughly depressing.
Well, as we start to get ready to wrap it up here, let's do maybe one or two other classic haunting stories to leave everybody with tonight.
Well, what I would like to do is go back to a gentleman by the name of Dan Leno, who I mentioned earlier. He was, as I said, a pantomime performer and suffered heavily from alcoholism, which he masked the incontinence anyway with his lavender scent. He was very, very much beloved. However, he was never, ever taken seriously as a performer, specifically Shakespearean roles he wanted to play was often turned down. He was well known and well loved, but he was not considered to be a classical actor. He was considered to be a comedy performer. This did not sit well with Leno at all, and that is what made him begin his drinking habits. It didn't help that his father and his stepfather before him had also become quite serious alcoholics. This affected his performance quite severely. He got into fights backstage with other performers. And he was also, at the same time, he was turning deaf, which means he missed a lot of his cues, so he was often late onto the stage. And unfortunately, in 1903, he was admitted into an insane asylum, which is a great beginning to a ghost story, if I ever hear one, an insane asylum. However, he overcome those issues and appeared in one more pantomime, and he was so good that he got an ovation that lasted for 5 minutes, and that's when he received the telegram from the king congratulating him on his performance. He didn't do much performing after that. In fact, he donated a large amount of money one day just walking into a hospital and donated the equivalent of about £500,000, which was pretty much his life savings. And he died in a pub in 1904. He is reported to be one of the more lively ghosts that is haunting the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. As I say, the lavender smell is one of the most common appearances that he has. But he's also reported to knock on actors' doors when it's time for them to go to the stage. Now, these days, when it's your time to go to the stage, you have a speaker in your dressing room, and the stage manager will call down to let you know it's your time. But back when Dan Leno was performing in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, it was a knock from the stage manager to let you know it was your time. And apparently he's still at it. He wasn't the one knocking at the time, but he certainly seems to have taken on the role of the stage manager now. And, of course, his famous clog dancing routine, it can still be heard in some of the dressing rooms. Now, we have a very well-known, it's not really active today, but it was a thing called music hall. I believe that in America the correct term would be variety. It was very, very popular pre-Second World War, and during the Second War, incredibly popular. It would be a two-hour show where you would have acrobats sometimes and comedians, magicians, sometimes performing dogs, singers, and they would all come. They would all have their 5 minutes, and then they'd move on. And they'd all be billed in order of fame and popularity. And Dan Leno's famous clog dancing routine was always top of the bill. And he can still apparently be heard practicing his clog dancing routine in the dressing rooms at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. That particularly is something that I would love to hear.
Now, earlier we looked at the photo, or I found the photo, and it was on a site called londonparanormal.com. I don't know if you have any recommendations for websites. Where can people go if they want to hear some other great stories from the UK theater scene? And obviously, let's get some information about you as well if people want to find out more about Christopher Keegan.
There are a few really good websites out there. The Stage, which is a UK-based theatrical newspaper that has quite a few articles on theatrical ghosts. There are some websites, haunted-london.com. You can find some information on haunted theatres there. And, you know, simply Googling London theatre ghosts will bring up plenty of stuff. And all the actors and performers that I've mentioned today, their histories are very well documented online. People like Grimaldi, Dan Leno, you can find their information on even Wikipedia. And in terms of myself, if you're interested in my acting work, my website, christopherkeegan.co.uk, or you can look me up on Twitter. Not my password, I won't be giving that out on the air. My username is C Keegs, so C-K-E-E-G-S. I don't tend to tweet too much unless I'm actually on a tour. But if anyone has any questions, please do feel free to send me a tweet, and I'll be happy to answer.
So ChristopherKeegan.co.uk, also available on Twitter at CKeegs. And as noted, if you're listening to this live on Friday night, you can go to my Twitter to find that photo of the ghost behind the two people taking the selfie, which is one of the creepier photos I've seen in a long time. And Christopher, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and maybe we can get you back on here in the future and talk some more haunted theaters, particularly if you do an investigation or if you finally hear that tap dancing.
Brian, it would be an absolute pleasure to be back on. Thank you for having me.
And thank you so much for listening, everybody. Back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network every Friday night, 11 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern. We are here live. If you are listening on a replay, perhaps Saturday on the Dark Matter Radio Network or throughout the week at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, you can always head up to the Dark Matter Radio Network Friday nights, 11 Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern, and hear this show live. We got another half hour here on the program. If you want to drop us a line, I'm going to give you a million ways to do so in case you tuned in the middle of that interview with Christopher Keegan talking haunted theaters in the UK. He is on Twitter at CKeegs. His website, ChristopherKeegan.co.uk. If you want to find out more, and our Twitter has gone crazy over the last hour or so during that interview, a lot of different comments here. Semper Vivi says he's commenting on died by the visitation from God, which is noted. I would like written on my, whatever they call that when you pass away, my death certificate, died via visitation from God. And he also wants us to stop talking about clowns again. Clowns, a very unpopular subject, at least among those who don't like clowns. Also, a lot of people commenting on the ghost photograph, which I have put up on my Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. If you haven't seen it yet, make sure you head up to Twitter and check that out. It is something else. Brad says, creepy, reminds me of The Grudge. He also says, this thing better not be a ghost. It travels through photos. Lots of people retweeting it. Jonathan here says, thanks for the pic. Won't be sleeping for the next 3 days. Anthony says, I think it's just a goth. Jeremy here says, there goes my sleep. Not a fan of the ghost in the selfie. Semper Vivi has a theory on the watch gimmick that was talked about on the program. I would put $5, he says, on subconscious muscle movement. Kind of seen the same thing with an old school pocket watch on a chain. Also here, Ryan has sent me a horrifying, horrifying photo. I guess this is a, I don't even know if I should retweet this. It's horrifying. It is a, I guess it's a clown who has some sort of thing growing out of his mouth. He is holding what appears to be the dead body. This is a painting, by the way. It's not a photograph. The dead body of a child, I guess, with, it appears the child has been bitten in the neck. Itsy Bitsy is on the child's shirt. The clown is holding a balloon. That is enough to give you nightmares for the rest of your life. Also here, it is a photo of a clown saying, "Go to bed." And not a friendly looking clown, I might add. People do not like clowns. So there you go. If you want to contact me on Twitter, I am at Brian Alvarez. If you want to give the show a call, open lines tonight. Anything you want to talk about. It doesn't have to be ghosts. Anything on your mind is fair game this evening. You can give us a call toll free, 855-478-4478. West of the Rockies, we're up at 425-488-0525. East of the Rockies, 425-482-1686. Of course, this is only if you're listening live on Friday night. If you call it any other time during the week, very unlikely anyone is going to pick up the phone. But if you are listening on Friday night, we are live right now. We are taking your phone calls. My email, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com is the email address. I am up on Twitter, as noted, at Brian Alvarez. And make sure you check out and like, please, our Facebook page, facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. A lot of people visit the Facebook page, and we do appreciate it. If you like the page, it helps Andrew out, and you can communicate with him when you do so as well. Tell him what you like, what you don't like, stories that interest you, and that sort of deal. We've got a lot of news stories here tonight. You're welcome to comment on any of these as well, if you so choose. 855-478-4478. Of course, if you've got any ghost stories, any strange sightings, anything that is on your mind, perhaps you, like Granny, have suffered a bout of global transient amnesia. I would love to hear about that as well. Anything that is on your mind, give me a call here tonight. This from the BBC. We know a lot about birds and how birds seem to have an internal system that helps them determine where they are going. I don't know what the exact technical term would be, but they have a good navigation system. I guess that's the best way to put it. Birds heard tornadoes coming and fled one day early. U.S. scientists say tracking data shows that five golden-winged warblers evacuated their nesting site one day before the April 2014 tornado outbreak. Geolocators showed the birds left the Appalachians and flew 400 miles south to the Gulf of Mexico. The next day, devastating storms swept across the south and central U.S. Writing in the Journal of Current Biology, ecologists suggest these birds and others may sense such extreme events with their keen, low-frequency hearing. Remarkably, the warblers had completed their seasonal migration just days earlier, settling down to nest after a 3,100-mile journey from Columbia. Dr. Henry Strebe from the University of California, Berkeley, said he initially set out to see if tracking the warblers was even possible. So, I think everybody is well aware of the stories of animals being able to sense, for example, when an earthquake is coming. Sometimes the animals will start acting very strange, and then the next day there is an earthquake. And some research has been done. I don't really know the extent of it. It's very difficult to research something like this because you don't know when an earthquake is going to hit. And earthquakes certainly don't hit on a regular basis in most parts of the world, so it is hard to control an experiment like this. You would be essentially hiring people to monitor animals every day and hope that one day when the animals freak out, the earthquake that will occur the next day is not going to destroy wherever you are, or whatever the case might be. But I know that there has been some investigation done into this, and it does appear that for some reason, some animals are able to sense when earthquakes are coming, for example. And now there seems to have been a little bit of research done into these birds, which appeared to have determined that tornadoes were about to hit, and they took off. Literally, they took off. So a very interesting story there. Obviously, we still have a lot to learn about animals, what animals can sense, what animals can feel, what animals think, etc. And I think there is a lot of interesting news that will come out of that in the next several years. Speaking of animals, this is a very interesting story that I really want to comment on. This from the Epoch Times. Did ancient Egyptians have airplanes? Mechanical engineer thinks so. The universe is full of mysteries, it says here. Out-of-place aircraft is a term applied to dozens of prehistoric objects found in various places around the world that seem to show a level of technological advancement incongruous with the times in which they were made. Uparts, these out-of-place aircraft, often frustrate conventional scientists, delight adventurous investigators open to alternative theories, and spark debate. The pyramids and other advanced artifacts from ancient Egypt continue to awe archaeologists and archaeology enthusiasts. But is it possible, the article says, the ancient Egyptians had aviation? A wooden carving from the 3rd century BC was found in a tomb in Saqqara, Egypt, in 1898. It was classified as a bird figure and placed with other bird carvings at the Cairo Museum, until Dr. Khalil Masiha, a medical doctor and Egyptologist, saw it in 1969 and realized it looked like the model airplanes he made as a child. This professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Houston, John Leinhard, explained in Engines of Our Ingenuity, an episode, the other birds had legs, this had none. The other birds had painted feathers. This had none. The other birds had horizontal tail feathers like a real bird. This strange wooden model tapered into a vertical rudder. One can also see that the wing has an airfoil cross section. It was all aerodynamically correct. Too much about the model, he said, was beyond coincidence. Some have said that what appears to be the vertical rudder of an airplane instead depicts twisted tail feathers, as shown, an example on birds adorning boat mastheads in a Khonsu temple relief. Now, actually, let me read this part here because this plays into what I'm going to say. Leinhard noted that the 3rd century was a time of great ingenuity. He wrote, "No one could have come this close to the real shape of flight without working on a larger scale. This little wooden model could hardly exist unless someone had worked with large light models or even with man-carrying virgins." Award-winning glider Martin Gregoire tried to replicate the results of Masiha's brother's experiment, however, and failed. He said without a tailplane, which is an opinion the artifact doesn't seem to ever have had, the Saqqara bird was completely unstable. So essentially, he thinks that it was either a weather vane or a child's toy. My question regarding this and other aircraft appearing artifacts from antiquity is this claim here that Leinhard makes that nobody could have come this close to the real shape of flight without working on a larger scale. Is that true? I don't work at Boeing. I don't build airplanes. I do, in fact, have friends who do. Maybe I should ask them. But when I was a kid, I made paper airplanes. And in fact, I will never forget a story from when I worked years ago at a gymnastics facility. And the guy who ran the gymnastics facility also worked at Boeing. And one day when I was making paper airplanes, he looked at me, and in a mocking and scoffing manner, he said, "I'll show you how to make a paper airplane." And he was a Boeing engineer, and he went into his office, and he was in there. This is a true story. He was in there for like 15 minutes, and he's putting together this paper airplane, this aerodynamically perfect paper airplane that is going to put my airplane to shame. And he came out, and he presents it, and it is the craziest paper airplane you've ever seen. It's got all of these, I don't know the technical terms, the tail fin. He says this right here will give it extra lift. He's explaining how superior this paper airplane is. And after much rigmarole, of course, he takes the paper airplane and he throws it to launch it into the air, and it immediately nosedived into the ground and crashed and burned. Funniest thing I've ever seen. Point of this is, I was able to make paper airplanes. I'm sure that this guy was able to make paper airplanes. I don't know if necessarily it is beyond reasonable doubt that some of these airplanes that people claim to have found in antiquity were ancient people trying to create some sort of model aircraft, not even aircraft, a model bird of their own that then they could throw like a model airplane. If you saw a bird in flight and you thought, let me make a small model where when I throw it, it will fly as well. And you look at birds, you look at how birds fly. Isn't that what an airplane in many ways is? It is an attempt to replicate the things that work with birds, for example, to keep an airplane aloft. You create wings, for example. It's got to have a certain body type. I mean, over years and years, is it that hard to believe that somebody could figure out how to make a replica bird, so to speak, what we today call an airplane, and they threw it and it flew short distances? That doesn't mean that they had to have been able to create a full-size version of this that carried a grown man, or that there were airplanes that flew like airplanes do today. I think that it's far more likely that these are just scale models, very small scale models of birds that were designed in such a way that they actually flew like model or paper airplanes. But the idea that these models are an indication that ancient man had and flew airplanes, I find that hard to believe. Why, for example, would we have the models, yet not the airplanes? If you want to give us a call tonight, 855-478-4478. Once again, that is 855-478-4478. Toll free in the United States and Canada. Ed in San Antonio here says, no way am I listening to this show while I am doing the paper route tonight. Apparently he's been on Twitter, but not listening to the actual show here. Also, Mark here has, and I'll retweet this to everybody if you want to see it. He says, there are hieroglyphs that show ancient flying machines. And he has shared with me a photo of one of these hieroglyphs. And in fact, if you want to look at that and conclude that it is an ancient flying machine, it is certainly possible to do so. I don't know what that means. Maybe Mark is right. These are flying machines. Maybe it is the imagination of the Egyptians that created such things. I mean, if our planet gets wiped out, but somehow, and I don't know how this would be possible, digital copies of movies and film and such were able to be discovered by a future generation, if they went back and watched, for example, Star Wars, and they saw lightsabers and laser guns and that sort of thing, would they then conclude that we as humans in the 21st century had lightsabers and laser guns? No, it was a fantasy movie. Is it possible that these were just the imagination of the Egyptians that they imagined? Wouldn't it be great if there was a flying object? Let me sketch what I believe it looks like. I don't know. But if you'd like to see this hieroglyph that appears to show ancient flying machines, it is up on my Twitter right now, at Brian Alvarez. So head up there and check that out. This from the New York Times, a great moment. Rover finds methane, a clue that Mars may harbor life. Life on Mars, it says, the notion may not be so far-fetched after all. A year after reporting that NASA's Curiosity rover had found no evidence of methane gas on Mars, all but dashing hopes that organisms might be living there now, scientists reversed themselves on Tuesday. Curiosity has now recorded a burst of methane that lasted at least 2 months. For now, scientists have only two possible explanations for the methane. One is that it is the waste product of certain living microbes. John P. Grotzinger, the mission's project scientist, says, it is one of the few hypotheses that we can propose that we must consider as we go forward. The scientists also reported that for the first time they had confirmed the presence of carbon-based organic molecules in a rock sample. The so-called organics are not direct signs of life, past or present, but they lend way to the possibility that Mars had the ingredients required for life and may even still have them. This is a really great moment for the mission, Dr. Grotzinger told a news conference here at the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union. What would you think if it were proven that there was life on Mars? Microbial life, mind you. I wonder what the reaction would be worldwide to the news that life is not exclusive to this Earth. Obviously, 100 years ago, this would be a huge story. 500 years ago, when the Earth was supposedly the center of the universe, everybody rotated around us. Inconceivable. But after all of these years, and all of these sci-fi movies, and everything that we know about life here on Earth, how do you think people would react if it were determined conclusively that there is life elsewhere? I haven't seen any recent polls, but in many polls, there are a fair amount of people that believe that we are being visited by UFOs. So obviously these people would not be concerned about the idea of life, microbial life on Mars. And I wonder if it would cause much of an uproar at all. It would be one of the biggest discoveries in the history of humanity. But part of me feels that for a lot of people, it only seems logical that there must be life of some sort outside of Earth. Maybe not necessarily intelligent life. It doesn't necessarily mean that UFOs have traveled here to this planet containing aliens. But the idea that microbial life or life in any form could only exist on Earth, when you consider the size, the vast size of the universe, even the vast size of our solar system, how many people today you think would really be bothered by the idea that there is life outside of this planet? I think that today it would be less of a story than ever. Still one of the biggest stories of all time. And we may be just maybe even months away from some sort of confirmation here on Mars. And I wonder how that will be received here on this planet if that news should ever come out. This is very interesting here. Bigfoot. A couple of articles here. This is from The Atlantic, City Lab, talking the year in Bigfoot. Two states led the nation in Sasquatch sightings, which have been on the decline since surging in the 2000s. There is a map here, Sasquatch sightings, U.S. and Canada. There have been, and these are only official reports, by the way. This does not count anybody who has not officially reported a Bigfoot sighting. I believe that the Bigfoot Field Researchers Association, I'm sorry, organization, I should know this. I've been on a BFRO investigation. The Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization has put together this map. I presume that the majority of recent sightings have been reported to the BFRO, and the others are, I suppose, going back in time and looking through old documents and old stories and finding out who believed they saw some sort of man ape in the woods. And it is very interesting to look at this map here because they have clustered all of the sightings together. And as you would expect, the Pacific Northwest is the most densely populated area in this country by Bigfoot, according to this map. And there are sightings all down the West Coast. There are a number of sightings on east of the Rockies as well, so to speak. A lot of them in Florida, a lot of them in the Appalachians, etc. But it is very, very interesting when you look at this map, and there are certain places in this country where there are zero Bigfoot sightings. And it is always fascinating to me because I always think if people are just making up these stories, if people are just imagining things, then shouldn't there be reports from everywhere where there are people? If there are woods and there are people, if people are just making these up or mistaking animals for Bigfoot, one would think that this would be scattered evenly throughout the United States. But no, there are very, very, very distinct clusters here on this map. Now, there is also a graph here showing the rise in Bigfoot sightings. And of course, this corresponds with the rise in reports, for example. I mean, you can go back to 1920, there are virtually no reports. But back then, this was long before there was even a word Bigfoot, long before the Patterson film here, for example, and long before anybody would have even thought of reporting anything resembling a Bigfoot. But as time goes on, you see this graph go up. There was a big spike in the mid-70s, and interestingly enough, the Patterson-Gimlin film did not lead to a large increase in sightings. It was 4, 5, 6 years before sightings began to spike after that Patterson film. Probably just a couple of years after Beast of Boggy Creek, in fact. They spike in the late 70s, they go down a little bit in the 80s, they drop quite a bit in the 90s, and then there is a huge spike in the year 2000. There is a giant spike in the year 2005, and it has fallen ever since. And 2013 is, honest to God here, in line with 1920. That is how few sightings there were in 2013. It appears that 2013 is the lowest number of sightings, according to this graph, since probably the 1950s, where there were very, very, very few sightings. There is a list here. City Lab's unofficial tally of the year in Bigfoot sightings. By state and report, so few reports. Alabama, 1. Colorado, 1. Florida, 1. Georgia, 2. Illinois, 3. Kansas, 1. Kentucky, 2. Maryland and Michigan, 1. Minnesota, 2. Missouri and Ohio, 1. Leading the list, believe it or not, well, one of them is easier, there's a tie. In first place, tied for first, is Washington, my home state. Only 4 Bigfoot reports in 2013. Can you believe that? 4 in all of Washington state. Tied for first place is, of all states, Pennsylvania, also with 4. Texas, 2. Virginia, 3. West Virginia, 1. Wisconsin, 1. And what do you note when you look at this map here and you hear all of those states and how many Bigfoot reports? Well, 0 reports in California. 0 reports in Oregon. What does this mean? There's an article here as well at BigfootEvidence.blogspot.com, and they are actually asking, are these sighting numbers for 2014 correct? City Lab has released an article covering the number of sightings per state for the year of 2014, noting Washington and Pennsylvania tied for first place with 4 apiece, and other hotbed states such as California and Oregon had 0. What does this mean? Why the decline in Bigfoot sightings here in 2013 and 2014, especially when you consider shows like Finding Bigfoot? One would think that with these shows on the air, there would be even more people reporting Bigfoot, and not significantly less. I don't know what this means, but a very, very bad year for Bigfoot sightings in 2013, and apparently a very, very bad year for Bigfoot sightings in 2014 as well. So if you want to check that out, Bigfoot Evidence .blogspot.com, taking a look at the sighting numbers for 2014. A lot of people retweeting stuff here on Twitter, including the hieroglyphs that allegedly show ancient flying machines. Once again, if you want to check this out, I have retweeted it on my Twitter, which is at Brian Alvarez, so head up there and check that out. Wouldn't be After Dark Radio without a threat of mass extinction. A massive, this from unexplained-mysteries.com, by the way, which is linked up at afterdarkradioshow.com, a massive and volatile star located 7,500 light years away is on the verge of going supernova. Social media has been abuzz lately with the news that a huge star called Eta Carinae might soon explode, causing a devastating burst of gamma rays capable of eradicating all life on our planet. The star is around 120 times the weight and 240 times the size of our sun, a cosmic behemoth that is literally tearing itself apart by the strength of its own light and heat. It is even possible the star may have already exploded thousands of years ago. Fortunately, however, the rumors of an impending apocalypse have been greatly exaggerated. There is no danger from this star exploding, as we simply are not close enough to it, and it is not pointing in our direction in any case, said Dr. Alan Duffy. It would have to be really close for a sterilization event, well within hundreds of light years, not the thousands of light years, like Eta Carinae. So while the explosion would be bad news for any inhabited planets in its vicinity, we are fortunately too far away for it to have any impact. Even if it were pointing in our direction, which it isn't, by the time the gamma ray burst reached us, it would have mostly dissipated, and Earth's magnetic field and atmosphere would have protected us from what was left. So, unfortunately for those of you that are ready to go, the end of the world is not upon us. And that is it for tonight, everybody. I want to thank you all so much for listening. We had a huge number of listeners tonight. This may have been our record, in fact. I very much appreciate it. Of course, if you are listening to this show on a stream, if you are listening to a replay, perhaps on the Dark Matter Radio Network on Saturday, or on the free stream, which is linked up at afterdarkradioshow.com, you can listen live every Friday night, 11 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern. We will be off, likely, for the next 2 weeks for the holidays, but we will return in January. Make sure you follow me on Twitter, at Brian Alvarez, in case, as they say in wrestling, plans change. If we end up doing a show, I'll give you all the information on Twitter, as well as on the website, afterdarkradioshow.com. This show is going to be replaying all day Saturday throughout the day at the Dark Matter Radio Network and on our website, afterdarkradioshow.com. We've got a free stream, and the MP3 will be available for download moments after we go off the air as well. So check out afterdarkradioshow.com. Support all of the shows on the Dark Matter Radio Network. So many great shows up there. So many great hosts and programs. Check it out. Hopefully the return of Art Bell coming up later on this summer as well. So let's get the Dark Matter Radio Network rocking. Please tell your friends about the Dark Matter Radio Network as well as this show and spread the word. So if I do not speak to you all before the new year, very happy holidays to all of you. Have a great holiday season. We'll be back again soon. Check out the Dark Matter Radio Network, AfterDarkRadioShow.com, and more. And until then, have a good night, and we'll talk to you again after a while.
Such a winsome.